Dear Poirier, now you may not know that I know this about you, but if I read correctly, you are the first person I've had as a guest on the show, and probably the first person I know, at least that I know of, who has undergone an exorcism. Is this true?
Yes. Yes.
How long ago was this?
It was when I was 13, so I'm not going to do the math, but it was a long time ago.
So you were a possessed child at the age of 13 and had to be exorcised.
Yes. I've had people tell me that it was very on brand because I had a lot of strange things that happened to me as a child. First, I was born on Friday the 13th on a full moon, and my mother's car caught on fire when she went into labor with me. So the exorcism actually isn't the final weird thing about my childhood and my history.
Okay. Well, we're definitely going to get to that and plenty other stuff right after this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
My guest who I was talking to is Dia Poirier. She resides in Florida. She says it's between Disney World and the Swamp, which to me pretty much is anywhere in southern Florida, so she leaves it wide open. She's had two series, the Calderwood Cases books and the Detective Harlow Durant books. And she has one maybe sort of kind of standalone, After You Died. And the reason I say it that way is I read in one place that this is considered a standalone novel. But on Amazon, it says it's Afterlife Book 1. So, Dia, you need to tell me, is it a first of a series or is this a standalone?
Technically, it is the first in a series. There is going to be a second novel at some point. I have not written it yet, but I do have it planned.
Okay, so After You Died, we'll just say as of right now, it is a standalone.
Correct, yes.
And then someday they'll be surprised with the second book.
Correct.
So we got to go back to where we started off. Tell me the story about the exorcism, when and why and what was the experience?
So I was a bit of what you might call a problem child.
Join the club.
I didn't fit in where I grew up in Oklahoma, and I was the kind of kid that wanted to dye my hair pink and listen to punk rock and play guitar in a very, very conservative city. And I was always drawn to the kind of weird, the macabre. I was a bit of a goth. I would say I'm probably very much still a goth. So I dressed in a lot of black. I wore a pentacle necklace. You know, I was as edgy as I could be as a 13-year-old. And my mother, I guess, felt that all of my behavior and my personality traits would only make sense if I were possessed by a demon. So one day when I got home from school, she and my grandmother had me get in the car with them, and they said that we were going for a ride. And I was like, where? And they wouldn't tell me where we were going. And we ended up going to downtown Oklahoma City and going into the basement of one of the sketchiest churches I've ever seen in my life. And my mother ushered me into this room, and I was surrounded by a group of people who were chanting around me and telling me that I needed to repel Satan. And I have to tell you, going through it, it was very much like an out-of-body experience. I think I just disassociated the whole time because I was like, this can't be real. Like, this can't be what's actually happening right now. So it took a lot of processing on the way home for me to be like, what is really even happening in my life right now?
Well, the way you described the church and the place you went down to, it sounds like Satan definitely would have got the hell out of there.
Yeah, and I mean, nothing changed, so I guess it's either who I am or the demon that just didn't work.
Now, mentioning that it's surreal, I mean, do you look back at it now and think, did that really happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's still just such a bizarre thing in my life that there are times I think back to it and I'm like, did that really happen? Like, was that just a dream? But no, it did happen. It was just so bizarre.
And it is also true your mother took an axe to your Ouija board?
Yes. So
now, did this happen after the exorcism?
I think it was very close in the same time period.
Mm-hmm.
The most hilarious thing to me is my stepmother had bought me a Milton Bradley Ouija board for my birthday and given it to me as a gift, obviously, because weird, edgy child. That's obviously the gift you get for a weird, edgy child is the ability to bring spirits into the world,
mm-hmm.
to communicate with them, obviously. So I brought home this Ouija board and my mother was livid. She took it, like, wordlessly took it from me, went into the backyard, and I followed her, wondering what the hell she was doing. She goes to our shed, grabs an axe, and proceeds to take the Ouija board out of the box and start chopping it up with an axe, screaming that she's repelling Satan. And the whole time, I'm like, this was made by the same people that make, like, Monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of spiritual tool would this even be? Like, what am I bringing into the world, or what am I communicating with, if it even works?
Well, see, that's how Satan lures you in. You have something as innocent as Monopoly, and then he gets you with the Ouija board.
Clearly. That's that's his grand plan all along.
Well, no offense to you or anyone out there in Oklahoma, but once you said that this was when you were growing up in Oklahoma, it kind of all made sense.
Yeah. I hear that a lot as well.
For a short story I released recently, it's mostly about leather guys, but there's a touch of BDSM in there. It's mentioned quite a bit, I should say. And when I was writing, I researched what were the most common safe words that people that are in BDSM use. And one of the most common was Oklahoma.
Oh my God.
Did you know that?
I did not.
And you wonder why. And I saw somebody wrote, why? Do you want to hear why they said that is? Most likely. I mean, it's their guess.
I would say because it's the biggest mood killer that there is.
You are almost dead on. Their wording was, once you get to Oklahoma, you know the fun has stopped.
Oh my God. It's so true. Oh God, it's true.
Well, I have never been to Oklahoma, so I can't say anything about it other than driving through Oklahoma City a few times. It wasn't the best, most beautiful city I ever saw, but that's about all I can say other than the movie or the play. So the novel that you or your publisher sent me was After You Died.
Yes.
Which is the one I mentioned earlier that is a standalone as of right now. And let's start with the main character, your protagonist, Asher Fleming.
Yes.
Tell us about Asher, that fine young man.
So I think I hate to play favorites because you never want to play favorites, but I would say that Asher is my favorite protagonist that I've created because
mm-hmm.
I myself love a very morally gray character. And Asher really fits a lot of that for me. He is someone who has an incredible capacity for love. And because of that love, he will do questionable things. And I really love that in a character. And I really liked how I was able to kind of play that out in a lot of the story. And I don't want to give a whole lot away, but I think I really captured Asher's love in different ways and how that compels him to act.
So he's got a lot of gray areas.
Yes. Yeah. I would say all of my characters have a lot of gray areas, but I would say Asher has more. Probably because of the supernatural elements, you don't necessarily know what he did or what he's capable of.
Well, I think that's true of most of us. We all have those gray areas.
Very true.
I say good for you for writing realistic characters.
Thank you.
The blurb on the novel says, it's a paranormal thriller based on true events. You know, I know you can't give too much away, but I want to tell you to tell us as much as you can about the story so that we can whet people's appetite. Because it's available right now for people to buy. And I also want to know the true story. Where did that come from and what's that about?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book itself is based in the 1960s in Florida. And we have Asher who has woken up covered in his girlfriend's blood after she's died. And he has no memory of what happened, how he got there, or how she died. And unfortunately, he ends up convicted for her murder because there's no other possible explanation for the police of who could have killed her. And he's sentenced to the Dozier School for Boys. And he's supposed to serve out his sentence there until he's 21, when he will be released. The Dozier School for Boys was a real place in Florida. It actually operated from the early 1900s until 2011 is when it finally got shut down. So many horrible things and atrocities happened at this school. Real boys were sentenced to this school for things as innocuous as skipping school. They would be sent there, they would be taken from their home, sentenced to this boarding school where many boys were tortured, beaten, and many died in the woods. You know, there's actually been excavation that's been going on at the school because they had originally only recorded that somewhere around 21 boys had died from things of like influenza and accidents. And they've found, I believe it's over 100 bodies now of...
Well, this is horrific. How come I've never heard of this?
Because it's one of the many things that the media doesn't cover. It's not as, I guess, sensational as some of the current events. So it's been kind of swept under the rug. You know, here in Florida, I only heard about it because they were covering very shortly on the news that they had discovered some of these bodies at the school that nobody knew were there. And so it's really horrific, but I really wanted to do justice to what happened at that school. And I did a lot of research. I read a lot of interviews from boys that were actually at the school and survived. And a lot of their stories are woven into the book.
So I generally don't ask people where they get their ideas from because it's so difficult for an author to answer. But in this case, I'm going to ask you because I'm curious, what came first? Did you think about the school and think, I can write a story about this? Or did you have an idea and decide to tie it in with the school?
Honestly, it came from hearing about the school. I've always been fascinated by places. And most of my early books were inspired by history and by places. And that's what my stories grew out of. When I heard about the school and I started reading some of the stories of the boys who were there, some who did nothing wrong, some who were falsely accused, that's when I got the idea for Asher and telling a story about a boy who was sentenced to the school for a crime he didn't commit and his journey to trying to dig through his memory to uncover what actually happened.
And you said this was, if I remember correctly, you said it was like a, for lack of a better term, a juvenile delinquent school?
Yes.
Where they sent problem kids. Was it affiliated with any church at all?
No, it was run by the state.
Oh, okay. Okay. Because where I grew up in North Carolina, we had a local military school. That's where everybody sent their problem kids.
Yeah.
We sent them there in Florida. They sent them to this very scary place.
Yes.
It sounds like it would be a great nonfiction story.
Yeah, there actually are some nonfiction novels written by some of the boys who lived at the school.
I'm not a huge fan of true crime podcasts, but I'm friends with a couple of people that run one. I'm going to toss this their way.
Yeah.
Because I've never heard anybody discuss this thing.
Yeah, it's something I really wish people spoke about more, especially in the state of Florida. I really wish there was more being done for the victims and the people that lived through this, because most of these boys are still alive. Like, there are victims that literally got released in 2011. I mean, this was very, very recent.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's good for you as an author that the school is no longer open because you were able to write the story. But it's unbelievable to me that it was around that long.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah, it's absolutely horrible. Obviously, this book has a high body count.
Yes.
Anyone that listens to the show knows that I enjoy cozies, but I also really love a high body count. Mostly I like PI novels, but high body counts are fun to me. So this book has all this going on, but it's the only one of your five books that are available that does not say it's about serial killers. So, but it really kind of sounds like it is to a degree. So you have five books with lots of people dying. What is up with that? No wonder she chopped up that Ouija board.
You know, it's something I've heard frequently. I get asked by a lot of people I know in real life who read my books. They're like, are you okay? Like, yeah, I am. It's just, I have never actually been able to sit down and write a story where somebody didn't die. Like, I don't know if that says something about my psyche or my brain, but that's just where my mind always goes. Anytime I hear something strange or something weird that sparks a story idea, it's always like, ooh, and then what if somebody died? That's where my brain just goes. So I would say my books that center around serial killers, it's because that was one of my first real fascinations as a teenager. I read a lot about serial killers, which I know doesn't sound great, but it led me to writing books. So I guess there is that. And I would say in a way, After You Died is about a serial killer as well, because trying not to give a lot away, but the bad guy is essentially a serial killer.
Well, I kind of guessed that one.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't think that's that odd. I mean, people have a fascination with serial killers, murder in general. I mean, that's why we have so many true crime podcasts. We have Dateline NBC and all these other shows. And if you think back when they had public hangings, there were huge crowds around. And I don't think it was all because, one, they wanted to see justice done. And I'm sure some of them were probably there for the gruesome factor. But I think mostly my guess is that it was just so fascinating because it was something that – it's the same reason we slow down when we see an accident on the highway.
Yeah, I can see that.
I don't want to see a dead body, but I kind of want to see the dead body.
I spoke to a medical examiner here in Florida when I was doing research for one of my books shortly before COVID, and they invited me to come do a tour of the medical examiner's office. And I was going to take them up on it, but then COVID struck and I haven't been able to, but I kind of want to go do it. I don't know that I want to see a body, but I would like to see a medical examiner's office.
Yeah, I think that would be kind of cool. I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you've written some police procedurals. How did you do most of your research?
So a lot of my research comes from, I actually have some textbooks on criminal investigations. And so I've done a lot of my research that way, a lot of Googling. I also actually have a couple members of current police teams that I can reach out to when I have questions, and then also some people who work on crime scenes. So I have quite a few people that I go and bounce ideas off of. There's been a few times where I'm like, oh, can I have this happen? And they're like, absolutely not. That would never work. And I'm like, oh, that was a key point of this book. Now I don't know how I'm going to work around that if that wouldn't actually happen. So I would say I draw from people, Google, and then textbooks.
Well, that's good that they told you that before you wrote it.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Because readers would have slammed you hard on that one.
Oh, yeah.
And things changed. My last book, I was going to have a body at the Hollywood sign. And I've been up to the Hollywood sign before. And I told my husband, I said, we better walk up there just so I can make sure everything looks the same. And along the way, I stopped and asked the park ranger. He said, nobody could get a body up there now. It's so protected. There's helicopters and we have cameras everywhere. And so I had to change the story a little bit. But I'm glad I asked.
Yeah. I do also wonder, I do wonder what the park ranger was thinking, though. Like, why do we want to bring a body up here and put it next to the Hollywood sign?
Actually, there was a guy that was scattered pieces and they found his head up there. But his lover has yet to say why, but his lover is in prison right now. No, actually, I told him I was writing a novel and I was going to put the body up to the Hollywood sign. And he said, I hope you're ready to write a different novel. I said, no, I'm just going to change some things.
Have him throw the pieces out of a helicopter over the Hollywood sign.
Actually, I just had it. I moved the body further down the hill.
Oh, well, that works too.
Just not. He wasn't up at the sign. As I was, I told somebody, I think it was Lev Arfiel when he was a guest, that people still go to the Hollywood sign and climb over the fence and touch the letters because it's a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. So it's worth it that they can get it on YouTube, but it's not a place you'd want to take a body to.
Yeah, I imagined it's very heavily trafficked.
Yeah, it wasn't. They beefed up the security after they replaced the sign. And then, of course, this is supposed to be about you, but I love talking about the Hollywood sign because it's a very interesting history. They beefed up the security and then somebody climbed the fence and changed Hollywood to Hollyweed. And everybody woke up in the morning and saw it was Hollyweed, and the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce owns the sign. And almost overnight, boom, helicopters, more cameras. They never wanted that to happen again. So
they had no sense of humor about it.
No, they didn't. It was somebody protesting. They wanted to make marijuana legal. Eventually it happened, but it was long after he pulled his stunt. It actually turned out it was a college professor, which I think was very interesting.
Oh.
But I think all he got was a misdemeanor for trespassing. Because he used plastic bags, so he didn't do anything to destroy the sign. So.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, back to you. What is one of the most interesting or strangest things that you've learned in your research?
I had to look up how long it would take a body to decompose inside of a crab trap.
And what, pray tell, is a crab trap? Is it what it sounds like? Like in the water?
Yeah, the like pods you throw in the water to catch crabs. My first book is set in Maine, and spoiler alert, one of the bodies is put inside of a crab pod and thrown into the water. And I'm like, how long would a body actually last in there, especially with it being so cold? And apparently not long, because it would be eaten by the crustaceans. Crabs apparently really like dead bodies. So
they like anything.
I was sitting there Googling that, and I was just questioning, like, what am I doing with my life?
I think every Mr. Redder I've talked to said that they hope the FBI never looks at their browsing history.
Yeah. I kind of hope that somebody just publishes mine after I'm dead. Just, you know what? Just print it all off, publish it. Maybe some people will get some enjoyment out of it.
I don't know if I want people to know where I've been. I don't know. I guess I wouldn't care at that point. So whatever. So that book came out last year, and I think it was the early part of last year, and you've written two books since then, the Detective Harlow Durant books?
Yes.
How are they different than this one?
So the Harlow Durant series is very similar to the Collierwood cases in that they're both very procedural. There's no supernatural elements to them. They're just pretty much what you would expect from a procedural thriller. They both follow a female detective solving crimes. I would say I love the Harlow Durant series because my main character is the daughter of a serial killer. So I had a lot of fun with really playing off their chapters from her childhood where you get to see what it was like to have a father who was a serial killer. And he told her bedtime stories about his victims, but didn't frame it as he was killing these women. He framed it as he was saving them. So he told her fairy tales essentially about his murders. And then she grows up to be a serial killer, she grows up to be a detective, like hunting serial killers. And there's a very interesting balance that she strikes between trying not to connect everything back to her father in her childhood.
That sounds engrossing.
It was really fun to write.
It sounds like it. Sounds like it.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know with a review. It helps build an audience and introduce more people to queer crime fiction. Apple and iTunes are where most people search for new shows, but if you don't use either, other apps that allow reviews include Podcast Addict, Overcast, and Spotify. Wherever you listen to podcasts, help spread the word to tune in to Queer Writers of Crime.
So there's something about you that I find absolutely fascinating. You have what's called aphantasia. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes.
Okay. I could tell people what aphantasia is because I had to look it up, but you know it more than I do. You live it. What is aphantasia?
So I have the complete absence of mental imagery. I have no pictures in my mind at all. So for instance, there are a lot of times that you will be told to close your eyes and imagine a beach. I can't do that. I actually realized this a couple years ago. I always thought that people were being figurative. I didn't think that you were actually supposed to picture a beach because I've never been able to. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, oh, that's weird. Why would they tell you to do that? And I had actually read a Reddit post about aphantasia. And I was like, holy shit, I have that. And I turned to my son and I was like, can you picture things in your mind? And he was like, yeah. And I called my mom and I was like, can you picture things in your mind? And she was like, yeah, of course I can. And I'm like, I can't do that. And she's like, oh, yes, you can. I'm like, no, no, I can't. Like, if I close my eyes and try to picture something, all I'm seeing is the back of my eyelids. All of my inner workings in my brain are verbal. Like, I don't have any pictures there. So, yeah.
I'm shocked that if I've ever heard of this, I don't remember it at all. So I'm curious, though, you said you had a child before you found out. And what I'm curious about, I have anosmia, which is the inability to smell.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have it these days because it can happen after you have COVID.
Yeah.
I was born that way back when nobody had it. And what I'm curious about is if you had the same experience. I didn't know what it was until I read a Newsweek article about as an anosmia. And I'm like, oh my God, that's what I have.
Yeah.
But until that point, I was very confused. Like mom would say, she would hold a flower up to her nose and say, ooh, pretty. And I would hold up a flower to my nose and say, ooh, pretty. But I didn't really know why we were doing that. And
yeah.
Did you experience that as well? Did you kind of know that something was a little off, but you weren't really sure?
I mean, I guess I didn't really understand. Like, because it's so hard for you to realize that the way you're viewing the world isn't the same way that everybody else is viewing the world. So I didn't realize that my experience was different or that people really could see things in their heads. I never thought that that was real because I can't. So it wasn't until I really read that I was that like kind of the light bulb went off and I was like, oh, huh, that's weird.
How are you able to write given that obstacle? Because I'm just fascinated that you can do it.
So typically, I have to look a lot of things up, and then I explain what I'm seeing. So, like, I'm also an artist, and I've never understood people's ability to recall something without seeing it and then being able to draw it. I have to look at a picture to be able to draw something.
Mm-hmm.
So I do the same thing with my writing. I Google what it is I'm trying to do. Like, when I start writing a book, I have no idea what my characters look like. I typically don't even write any descriptions until my final draft because I have no idea what any of that stuff looks like. And it takes me too long to look up all the different nuances. And then I have mm-hmm. to keep a spreadsheet with all my descriptions so I can keep them straight. So I have made myself lists of like all my character names and then how tall I made them and what color their hair is and any other like distinguishing feature that I want to include. I always worry that people are going to be like, oh, well, you said they had blonde hair and now they have brown hair. And I'm just like, I have no idea what color their hair is because in my brain, they don't have hair color. I don't see them. So it's just a lot of Googling pictures and then describing what I see in the pictures and hoping that other people understand what those words mean.
So considering that you have that concern where you'll say they're blonde and then later brown, do you keep a Bible on your characters?
Yeah, I keep that Excel sheet of like just being able to reference them anytime that I have to write more of their description in the book. What I absolutely love though is there was a book blogger who did a cast for one of my books and he picked what all of my characters looked like all of the actors that would play them in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, like, as someone with aphantasia, that was one of the coolest experiences of my life because I have no idea what my characters look like. So for someone who read my book to be able to say, oh, this is definitely this character, was fascinating because I've always loved adaptations of books because I don't know when I'm reading the book what these characters look like. Like if I'm reading
mm-hmm.
Lord of the Rings, I don't know what those characters look like. I have no idea about any of that. If I'm reading any novel, I have no idea. So to be able to have a graphic novel of it or a movie of it, to be able to reference those characters, it's so helpful because otherwise I miss that part.
Yeah, because that seems like a large part of the enjoyment of writing reading a novel is the visualization part. Do you read graphic novels you just mentioned?
Yes, I do read graphic novels. Yes.
Okay, because I presume that's much easier for you.
It is. I also listen to a lot of audiobooks because I find that much easier for me to process books anyway. But yeah, I love graphic novels. I love anything that like includes a picture, like a map. I absolutely love when those are added into books.
Well, I think the Lord of the Rings books has a map of, I forget what it's called, but...
Yeah.
So that helps you?
Yeah, it does. It's very helpful.
Nothing to do with mysteries, I've got to ask, because since you read graphic novels, did you read The Walking Dead?
Of course I did, yeah.
Oh, okay, because I love the show. I've stopped watching. I don't hate it as much as everybody else that's watched it, but I've stopped watching. But it's good to hear. You're good peeps then.
Yeah, I absolutely love The Walking Dead. I hate to be one of those. I read it before it was a show, but I did. And I was absolutely fascinated by it because I love dystopians. I love zombies. So Walking Dead was really like a hit for me. I absolutely loved it.
I'm curious when you said a friend of yours put together pictures of your characters. When you look somebody up online, do you not keep that picture handy?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I'm not great about it.
Because I'm asking because I actually do that. I tend to not use celebrities. Two of my characters are based on celebrities. I'll never mention them because I like my readers to fill in the blanks themselves. But I like if I wanted a 30-year-old redhead, I'll put 30-year-old redhead man. And I'll look through all the responses on Google and pick one that, oh, that guy's perfect. So I'm surprised that you don't do that and how you're able to keep that continuity.
I would say most of the time I don't get so specific with any like facial details or anything like that, that I don't think any of it would matter even if I didn't keep the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess since I don't see that in my head, I guess I don't really feel like it's necessary to the text. I feel like most of the time the reader is kind of filling in what they think the person looks like. At least that's what I understand from people who see the pictures of their heads when they read.
Have you had any complaints in your reviews about that?
No, I haven't. I've actually had a lot of people say that like I do a really good job of like setting the atmosphere and making them really feel like they're there. And I'm like, well, I'm really glad because I have no idea what there looks like.
Because I do the same. I try to give as little detail as possible. I'd rather the reader picture rather like I'm trying to think, is it an author that describes a room in perfect detail? I think then the rest of the novel, I have to try and remember this room in perfect detail. So I'd rather have it just sketched and let me fill in the blanks and I'll use that through the rest of the novel.
And yeah.
Stephen King wrote once that he doesn't describe people's clothing because it's unimportant unless their clothing is important to their personality or important to that particular part of the story. I have noticed when I read his books, he does that probably more than he thinks he does. I mean, describes it. But I'm just telling you, there's nothing wrong with that. It works for Stephen King and works for the rest of us.
Very true.
Well, now with the anosmia, what I've had to do is I've had scenes in restaurants and I've had my current work in progress. I have a barbecue and I've had to have other authors describe it for me. And I actually had one author write the scene and then I kind of changed it to my own voice because I just had no concept. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had to do that?
Yeah. The weirdest thing for me is, so my husband didn't really, I don't want to say he didn't believe that I couldn't picture things in my head. He just didn't understand the concept. And so one day I was working on my book and I was like, what is it like to daydream? And he was like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, I don't do that. Like I don't drift off because I don't picture anything. So like occasionally like words will come into my mind, but what is it like to visually daydream? Is it an actual dream? Like, are you seeing the room and your thought at the same time? Like, I don't get it. I think for him, that's when it really clicked. And he was like, oh, you really cannot see anything in your head. So I definitely do that because I don't, most of my dreams aren't even visual. Most of them are just kind of like feelings or words and sounds. Occasionally I'll get a picture, but I don't think from what I understand from what others have said that it's typical for visual dreamers. So I think most of the time I'm just asking questions more around what it's like to daydream and then what it's like to picture things, because I guess I don't understand, like, the layering. Do you see the room you're in? Do you see the beach in front of the room that you're in? Like, can you see both at the same time? Like, I cannot understand the concept.
Wow. I'm thinking back when I was like 10, I had a dream about the house that we lived in when I was 2. And I described it to my mom and she goes, yeah, that was it. And that would never happen with you.
No, actually, even my memories aren't visual. So, like, I can't close my eyes right now and tell you what my mom looks like. I would have to see my mom. I can't picture my son in my head. Like, I don't have that ability. So, like, even my memories aren't visual.
Does it bug you that people are so curious about that or find it or have a hard time understanding it?
No, it doesn't bother me because I'm also fascinated by the way that other people are able to perceive things in their own mind because it's so different than my experience. So I guess there's like a full range of what you can and can't see in your mind. I guess some people have like the super ability to do a full movie in their head. And then some people are just able to kind of see snippets. And then some people are able to just see shapes. And so I find that fascinating because I'm like, well, what level are you? Like, how detailed is your brain?
Well, the reason I ask that question when I tell people that I can't smell anything and never have, they ask me like 1,000 times, really, really, really? And I'm like, people are blind. You don't question that. Why is this so weird, you know? But I guess because it's not that common. But given that, it's not surprising that you are a plotter, meaning that you write an outline, because I would think it would be critical for you.
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely critical. I am I would say, hyper plotter. I write a very detailed synopsis before I start writing a book, and then I break it down chapter by chapter, and I detail every single thing that's going to happen in each of those chapters. And then when I go through my editing process, I also have editing outlines to be able to make sure that I'm hitting all the points that I need to in each of the chapters. So yeah, very much.
And I'm curious, when you say you write what's in the chapter in detail, are you writing bullet points or are you actually writing it out like you're writing, only not as detailed and certainly not as well-written as you would normally?
Bullet points.
Bullet points?
Yeah. Just like, so if I know that a body has to be found in that chapter, I will write body gets found. I'll write any critical details about that body, the evidence that needs to be in the scene that the character has to notice, an outline of the critical conversations or the dialogue that has to happen there. And then however that scene flows into the next one.
So from outline to publication, how much changes? I'm guessing probably not much.
No. I would say for my Harlow Durant series, from my draft that was delivered to my publisher, I would say maybe 5% of it changed.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me given the way you work and the way your brain works. That doesn't surprise me at all. But something else about you really interests me because I can't figure out how in the hell you do it. I read a Writer's Digest article, and I can't remember if you wrote it or you were interviewed. But you said you write 4 manuscripts at once.
Yes.
Now, I get a million ideas, and I want to drop what I'm doing and go for the new, bright, shiny. And I have to really force myself. No, finish what you're doing because you're still enjoying that. I can only do one at a time. I make notes so I don't forget. How in the hell are you able to do that?
I think it might have something to do with how my brain works in that I'm very good at compartmentalization. So essentially, when I decide to work on that story that day, I'm able to only focus on that story. And essentially, all of my other thoughts around the other stories are just on the back burner. And if I have a thought on another story at some point, I will just write it in my notes, like, to look at later. But I guess I'm just able to make myself only focus on that one because I know I have a list of things. So it's like I have to do two chapters in this manuscript, and then after that I can do one chapter in the next manuscript, and then after that I can edit the third one. So I just kind of know that, like, this is the process and the order that I have to go in, and then I'm able to balance it that way. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
No, it actually makes perfect sense that while you're writing one novel, you don't have the scenes swirling in your head.
No, I don't have any of those pictures. Yeah, there's nothing like distracting me.
So in that sense, you have an advantage.
Maybe so. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love. I mean, I have a hard time getting one at a time. That's great. I mean, that you're able to do that.
I think it sometimes it can be to my detriment a little bit, because when I'm finished with a book and I send it off and it's done, I don't ever think about that book again. Like, I'm able to just, like, shut it out of my mind and be like, it's done. It's in a pod. We're, like, shooting it out into the universe, and we aren't ever going to think about it again. And so sometimes people will be like, so what happened in that book? And I'm like, give me a second. I'll have to, like, really think about it, because I'm just able to, like, shift to the next thing and be like, we're not going to think about that one anymore. It's done.
One advantage to that I see is a lot of authors I know will write several novels and they'll hold them because, well, Netflix has taught us that people like to binge watch, and there's people that like to binge read. So they don't release all the books at once, but they'll release, you know, they'll release one, and then the one that is already written, they'll hold it for a few months, and then they'll release that, and then they'll hold it for a few months. And those of you who've been waiting for my second novel, that is not what I'm doing right now. I'm just slow. But I think it's a good marketing tool, and I think it works well for them. So maybe that helps you in that sense.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
So now I'm going to go completely off the rails. I want to talk about Godzilla.
Okay, perfect.
You mentioned you're an artist, and you actually, my understanding is you have some art hanging in Art Museum in Orlando. Is that correct?
Yes. I'm a part of a show right now in Orlando. It's at the City Arts Gallery. Mm-hmm. I've got 5 pieces up there right now.
Well, I'm going to keep the listener hanging about this whole Godzilla thing because I'm curious. Do you use oil or watercolor?
So I use oil. Sometimes I'll use acrylics if I'm impatient, but typically oil is my medium.
And what style do you paint?
I'm not really sure what the style would be. I would say I'm slightly abstract. The series that's up in City Arts right now is Skeletal Birds. So it's like a study of different bird skeletons, and then I have some of their feathers, and then they're all on top of abstract backgrounds.
Oh, sounds very cool. Are they on your Instagram page?
They are, yes.
Oh, I'm going to look for them. I got to check those out. So back to Godzilla.
Yes.
Now the listener won't have to keep hanging on this. I grew up in a small town in Michigan. I actually lived out in the township, and I was a huge Godzilla fanatic with my friends, and we used to bike way into town to go see the theater. I'm not going to tell you how much we paid because you'll show how old I am, but we used to ride our bikes all the way into downtown to watch the latest Godzilla movies. Now, I will say, as an adult, I was a little disappointed to find out it was only 2.5 miles, because when I was a kid, it seemed like 30. But so when I found out about this Godzilla passion you have, I was like, oh, I love her. I love her. You have a site, the Mother of Godzilla. Is it called the Mother of Godzilla site?
Yes.
And I pulled it up, and it made me laugh. I mean, you've got Godzilla photoshopped everywhere imaginable. It looks like you have hundreds of these.
Yeah, I think I'm actually over 1,000.
Yeah, because I was thinking, okay, I'm going to see how many dozen just so I can count it. And then I'm like, wait a minute. And I started scrolling down and said, screw that. There's no way I can figure out how many. I'd be here all night. But you have Godzilla standing in different countries like Norway, Switzerland, Iceland. I'm sure here in the United States, there were a ton of different countries. But then you have some, like, you have at least 2 where Godzilla is with Deadpool, which to me shows you're a Deadpool fan, which again means you're good peeps. But you have Godzilla in a NASA spacesuit. You did just a recent one where he's fallen into a cup of coffee. Explain this Godzilla fascination, because I'm fascinated by this fascination. It's so fun.
I've always loved monsters. Like, monster movies were always it for me. I was a horror fanatic, and then I discovered monster movies and Godzilla. And I think Godzilla really plays into my love of the morally gray character, you know, because Godzilla's trying to do a good thing. He's trying to fight other monsters to save whatever city, I think, in Godzilla's mind. That's how I see it.
Not in the first one.
Not in the first one. But maybe it's misunderstood. Maybe there's something that we don't understand.
There you go.
I just love a good monster. And Godzilla, to me, has just always been like the pinnacle of the best monster. And it was like, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago, as a joke, I was a graphic artist very early on in my career. And I still like to Photoshop weird things just to keep my skills sharp. So I was like, I'm going to Photoshop Godzilla into the countryside just because it'll make me happy. And so I did. And I put it on Twitter and people thought it was hilarious. And so I was like, all right, I'll put him in some other weird places. And so I just started doing that. Like a few times a week, I would Photoshop Godzilla in weird places. And then I was like, oh, what if I put him in some Renaissance paintings? So I put him in like the Mona Lisa, and I did the Birth of Venus with Godzilla coming out of the shell. And then I started doing weird animal hybrids. So there's like a chicken with a Godzilla head, and a lot of people love them. Like, they've gone viral a few times. And I love seeing the joy that they bring to people. So, yeah.
And I heard that some of your pictures were published in the news somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't remember. Somewhere overseas.
Yeah. So I had posted some on Facebook years ago. And they ended up on Reddit, and I guess they got the attention of a journalist in the UK, and the journalist had asked if I would Photoshop Godzilla at some of the local attractions in Scotland, and I was like, sure. So I did, and it was in the newspaper in Scotland and on their website, and I actually got a message from the person who manages the castle that I Photoshopped Godzilla at. And they printed it out. Their kid was so thrilled that I had done it. And they were like, if you ever come, like, I will give you a free tour of the castle.
They should fill the castle with your Godzilla Photoshops.
I know. That should be on the front of the castle.
Well, given your love for Godzilla, I have to ask you one question. What do you think of Godzuki?
Not my favorite.
And for those of you that don't know Godzilla, first of all, you're strange. But second of all, Godzuki is Godzilla's child. I don't know how it happened because we only see one Godzilla-like creature. And he's in there for comic relief in some of the later movies. And it's not funny at all. But anyway.
Yeah, no.
No, it's kind of like Scrappy-Doo. Like, why? Why?
It just fell flat. Like, I feel like there's so much that could be done with baby Godzillas, and I really hope that maybe Toho does with like Shin Godzilla going forward. Like, maybe we'll see some baby Godzillas that are on the more serious and like darker side. I think there's a lot to be done there, but yeah, it fell flat for me.
Well, they had a good opportunity in the Matthew Broderick Godzilla movie, except they made it way too much like the Velociraptors in Jurassic Park. It ruined it for me, but they were on the right track. I mean, Godzuki. You know, Godzilla spits out fire and Godzuki puffs out smoke and gets frustrated because that's all he gets out is smoke. And anyway, moving on, for those that don't give a damn about Godzilla, I had scratched some notes about Twitter, and I didn't think we'd probably have time to get there. But since you brought it up, I'm going to bring it up. I don't use Twitter a whole lot. I used to use it more, but I got excited when I got almost 1,500, I have about 1,500 followers, and I got them almost overnight by two posts that I had that went viral. So I'm like, oh my God, I got 1,500 because of these two posts that went viral. You have over 17,000 followers on Twitter. Did you plan on ever growing that line? I mean, did you plan on it being a medium that you could, or like a source to a marketing source? That's the word I'm looking for.
No, never. My Twitter following grew a lot faster than I expected and is still growing faster than I expected. I think I just lucked out. I had a few of my tweets go very, very viral, and I ended up with a lot of followers from that. Like, some of these tweets still haunt me to this day on Instagram and every other platform. And yeah, I mean, it's not anything I ever planned. And I do always wonder, like, why are all these people following me sometimes? Yeah. But, you know, it's really fun to be able to connect with other authors and readers and to be able to bring people joy with Godzilla. So, yeah.
Do you get into politics at all?
I do. Yep, quite a bit. I actually, I minored in political science, so quite political.
So how often do you have to block people?
Very often. Typically when I see stupid posts about Ron DeSantis, I just go and block everybody that posted anything under there. Yeah, lots of blocking.
Yeah, I got so tired of it. I created another account that was called like Brainy Ass or something like that. I don't know what it was. And I didn't put my own picture. And I put, you know, I'm just tired of I listed off things I've been called that were ridiculous because they were contradictory of each other. And I said, so I'm not using my real picture and I make no apologies. But I actually stopped using that. Now I use my original one again. That's a rabbit hole you can fall down into. And boy, you can get lost in there.
It is. But, you know, I'm very passionate about standing up for, you know, the LGBTQ plus community and staying vocal in politics as much as I can, especially with my platform. I know that there's good that I can do. So I try to do the good that I can. And I definitely see there being a lot of like dangerous things going on in this country. And I really feel like when you become an author and somewhat a public figure, you do have to speak on those things because you can't be silent forever.
Well, I've said this before, but I have to say it to you because I think you'll appreciate this. You remember when people like would get excited because Donald Trump would block them?
Yeah.
Because it showed that they really pissed him off. And of course, then the courts told him he can't block people anymore. After that happened, I got blocked by Eric Trump and I was so excited.
Oh my God. The dream. Living the dream.
It was. I was like, yes, yes. I can't remember what it was. I think it was one of the two that went viral. But I was so happy. I had to tell everybody.
Good job.
Yeah, exactly. But I never got the chance to get blocked by the Donald. But that's okay. I'm glad he was off of there anyway. So your day job, you work in marketing. And I want to bring it up because you are a director of email and lifecycle marketing. And I want to bring it up because what the hell is lifecycle marketing?
So I'm not any longer.
Oh.
I was previously. I'm currently a CRM technical manager. So I work on the technical side of CRM systems. So I started my career as a developer and then worked very heavily in marketing, a lot of it having to do with email and lifecycle marketing. And so a lot of the lifecycle I was in charge of was building essentially customer paths inside of marketing technologies of the flows in email that you receive. So your welcome email saying, hello, you just signed up, and coupons you're going to get from day to day, those sorts of things.
You were a computer programmer before all of this, right?
Yes. So I started my career. I did PHP, MySQL, and then a lot of front-end web development.
Well, something that interests me with that, because I used to work with SQL and I did a little bit of programming. But when I did it, the reason I felt like I was good at it is because I could see, almost like the Matrix, I could see the inner workings of the computer. So again, going back to the aphantasia, it's interesting because the way I was able to process it obviously is much different than the way that you're able to process it.
Yeah, I never saw anything visual having to do with programming. I actually had, it was very difficult for me as someone with aphantasia to do design and working with design clients. And I think that's part of the reason I moved out of it was because I heard a lot of feedback that I clearly wasn't understanding what they were visualizing. And I was like, yeah, I don't. Like, I have no idea what you mean. So I would ask for specific examples. I'd be like, show me something that looks like what you want this to look like, and I will make it like that. But when someone's like, well, I want it blue, and I want it square, and I want orange leaves on it, and like as they're describing these things to me, I'm like, I have no idea what any of that means or how that would work. Like it was just gibberish to me. It didn't work.
Yeah. Like my graphic designer, I just kind of spew out a few words and she gets exactly what I want. And I couldn't do that. So I imagine that would be next to impossible for you.
Yeah, it was not easy.
And I got to tell you something I really hate. I really hate that we are at the end of this interview because I think I could just go on with you for days.
Oh. It's been so fun.
It has been fun. It's gone so fast.
Yes, it has. I didn't realize we were already at an hour.
Yeah, we most definitely have. Just to remind everybody, this is Dia Poirier, and the book we talk the most about is After You Died, but she has five novels, so I'll leave a link to After You Died in the show notes, but you can also click on her link and check out the other novels, which are different than this one, because this is the only one that's paranormal. And I will tell you, we have a lot of listeners that are big paranormal fans.
Oh, great.
So that's good. Well, thank you again. It's been a pleasure talking to you and having you on the show.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.